He was the best of us, said the half-hand, and the worst as well. Only fools like Thorin Smallwood despise the wildlings. They're as brave as we are, John, as strong, as quick, as clever, but they have no discipline. They name themselves the Free Folk, and each one thinks himself as good as a king and wiser than a maester. Mance was the same. He never learned how to obey. Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we thought it was best to rename and rebrand ourselves as the game did so with a second edition. Now, we are the White Book Podcast, and each week we bring you your dose of strategy, insight, and all-around geeky goodness. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, but more importantly to you, our listeners. Please consider supporting us on Patreon so that we can continue to make this show the best it can, and I promise we have big plans for the future. This is The White Book.
So the Free Folk are Americans, right?
Yeah.
Wow, Wright opens the episode with a snort.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I can say any more after that, because the jokes I go to are ones I would then feel obliged to cut from the episode. So I'm not gonna make myself do work to edit my own comments.
I mean, you're a wise man, Will. That's why you've been doing this for so long.
Yeah, exactly.
7,000 episodes in.
Oh, God, I hope we don't make it that long.
I mean, I literally don't think we can.
I mean,
we'll not survive that many episodes.
I don't think what are we at now? Like 4 something? 3 something?
I'm a little fuzzy on when this will actually release, because it was a little screwed up thanks to the trip and nationals, and there's still another episode in the can that hasn't been released. So I think when this one comes out, it'll be 347, I think.
So, yeah, there's no way.
Yeah.
Unless we start releasing daily Game of Thrones podcasts.
I like it. We cut them down to 10-minute episodes. We start going daily.
I mean, honestly, if you just rebrand all 18 of our other podcasts as White Book and give them episodes, you'll have one a day, right? Like, White Book, The Wars to Come, which is episode 148, and then Second Sons. What's your thing?
The How and the Why of It.
The How and the Why of It. The White Book, episode 152, or, you know?
There we go. If we could get everybody all on the same page. I think it might be hard to get banter on board, though.
Do they even release episodes?
Yeah. You know, I don't know, every 6 weeks or so-ish?
Besides, are they part of the White Book podcast family?
Well, I mean, we haven't pulled any of them co-hosts, but I just figured if we're going to kind of subsume all of the podcasts, like, we might as well do all of podcasts, right?
I mean, the ones that release. Well, those lazy Brits don't release podcasts.
No, I'm sure they'll put one out soon. I saw news that they're making a new police academy. Like, they're gonna have to talk about that hot news.
It's just gonna be fucking Bamford making sound effects like Winston for the entire fucking time.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Winslow.
I don't know. It's been too long since I've watched him. I guess I should fix that.
Yeah, get your life together.
Hey, I might have some time to do that now the rest of this year. So, fingers crossed.
Oh.
I hope so.
Roy. Oh. Roy wants the best for you.
I do. Well, I do truly want the best for Will.
Thank you.
You're extra earnest when you're melting.
Yeah. That's my melting? Number one slot, but we're not there. So,
oh, we'll get there. Okay. We'll get there. We'll get there. Well, let's get moving there. Before we get to the main topic, though, we do have ourselves a giveaway. And this time, Will thought ahead. He opened up the Patreon list, already ran the random number generator, and wrote it down before we got here. So I can just read off that I had a few extra Nationals shot glasses and various prizes. So those are going to basically turn into podcast giveaway items so that I'm not hanging on to stuff. So we're going to give a shot glass to someone who, thankfully, was also not at Nationals. There's a lot we're giving away there. To Trey A.
I'm Trey also
making Aaron Guest.
Biggest the second, fan of the Second Sons.
The Second Sons' number one fan. Literally the only fan that I like and want to listen to the podcast. The rest of you, please stop listening. It's really annoying.
Wow.
I would like nice listening.
I hate that we have
fans. He hates it so much that he's on it every other week.
I mean, I like talking to my friends about cards. I just don't need other people to listen. Besides Trey.
Well, just record them and send them straight to Trey. Don't put them out there where other people can watch. I mean,
so the problem is we decided to do it as lazily as possible. So we just stick it on Twitch so we don't have to stress it.
Ah, okay.
It could be worse or better. We don't have Jesse shirtless on our podcast all the time.
That's true. We don't. Yeah. That's the saddest thing about our
life.
Our life, our podcast.
Hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
Really depends on your point of view there, I suppose.
I'm pretty sure it's pretty universal that people want to see Jesse without a shirt on.
But we just care too much about Buzz. He's a Twitch partner. So, like, we got to be careful.
Is he really?
We don't want him to get banned from Twitch, so we can't have topless Jesse. But the masses demand it. But for the sake of equality, both men and women cannot have their shirts off on Twitch.
Really, I did not know that. How do they release their episodes where Jesse's never wearing a shirt?
They usually don't.
Oh, okay then.
Well, like Jesse keeps a shirt on when they are live streaming. Usually.
I have never listened to an episode of either Wars to Come or The Second Sons, so this is all news to me.
Well, you participate in episodes of The Second Sons, so you don't necessarily have to listen to them.
Yeah, but I don't really listen, right?
That is true. Truer things have never been said.
Listen, like, to your co-hosts while you're doing the episode, or what are we talking here?
I mean, right now I'm playing a video game. I'm completely on autopilot.
Hey, at least just, like, don't do the dishes. Like, it's a pretty low bar to stay under, right?
I mean, Kyle Vansel, a pretty low bar to stay under.
Ooh.
Got it.
Ouch.
Yeah.
I just edited a deck for him, like, 30 seconds ago.
Next week, we'll invite Kyle on to offer the rebuttal on this particular topic.
It's fine. He'll tell us he's going to be on, then last minute does not show up. It's Kyle. It's no big deal.
We'll see how it goes.
I'm firing shots so that he has to come back.
I will be sure to pass it on because I don't think he ever bothers to listen to the episodes either. So I'll have to tell him.
He should. I mean, our episodes are way better than his. He should definitely be listening.
Oh, ouch. Well,
I mean, right? Bro, you actually listen?
I do. I have no comment.
I mean, at the rate we are going today, this episode might be markedly worse. This isn't even really banter. This is just us talking about random stuff.
I'm just grumpy, so I'm going to be mean about people and things. So
I mean, that's just normal.
That's how I handle my anger. Hey, I've been in a fairly good mood lately. Not that anyone bothered to notice.
Sorry, I was preoccupied.
It waxes and wanes like the moon.
Gotcha.
The tides.
Like your legs.
Yeah, now you're really getting sexy there, Glazer.
Who?
Well, we can handle that. We can handle that.
That is definitely time to force a segue then.
White Book After Dark. Sure. So we use Aaron and I are teachers. We use a system close approximation to the American letter grade system, with A being the highest rating of most normal cards. Hold on, we'll get there. Most normal cards. There's definitely some A cards in this pack that we'll get to. These are the best cards. These are the cornerstone cards of decks. They change the metagame the moment they're printed. The next would be B. These are good cards. These are cards that often have a bit more of a niche application than A cards, but still very powerful, very strong cards. C, these are your average cards, your filler cards, your cards that, you know, you may see some play, but definitely they're not the kind of cards you want to play, but they, except in very narrow situations, and they're usually the first thing you want to cut when new cards are printed. Then we have D's. These are cards that may see play in the future, but generally are just us being kind to poor design decisions by FFG. Then there are, of course, F's. These cards are future proxy fuel. They are the worst cards and just generally not very good. And then we have two special ratings. The first is the James Wamsley honorary E rating. These are extremely narrow cards that have a deck. They're build-around cards. They're decks that only in one deck can you ever conceive it being played. They are a way for us to dodge difficult choices and to drive frequent listener James Wamsley crazy. And then the final is S tier. These are cards that transcend good or bad. They are simply the best cards printed. Flea Bottom is the number one example of an S tier card. Did I cover that pretty well?
I think you only left out one minor nod. I think, haven't we also been using E cards for very narrow answer cards?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But otherwise,
we have phenomenal.
There we go. So should I jump into it?
Yeah.
So this is the nightmare of first edition players everywhere. Also the namesake of my dog, Mira Reed. She is a loyal two-cost Stark character. She has a red and green icons with one strength. She is House Reed Lady. She has Shadow 1 and Stealth and two reactions. Reaction, after a Stark character you control is sacrificed, return Mira Reed to Shadows. Reaction, after Mira Reed comes out of Shadows, choose one character. Until end of phase, treat it as if its printed text box were blank, except for traits. And it was a card designed by 2010 Castle Stalic champion. I'm going to mispronounce Guado's name. Andre Guadoni? Andrea Guadoni?
Guadalini?
I think so.
Whatever. I am terrible. I apologize in advance.
AGOTCards.org.
Yes, the originator of AGOTCards.org. His online handle was Guado for a long time. Shaggy Dog is the other Stark card, which is a three-cost non-loyal direwolf attachment, and it is Stark character you control only. Reaction, after you win a challenge which attached character is attacking, the losing opponent must choose and kill a defending character. Action, pay one gold to attach Shaggy Dog to a different character, limit once per base. I guess, why don't we start with Shaggy Dog? Because Mira is going to probably take up a lot more time. I think Shaggy Dog's pretty good. He's good, I think, in decks that want to use Kid Plot to cheat him out. And he's kind of like a movable throwing axe. And throwing axe has always kind of been like almost kind of wish it could be playable. But the fact that you can move him around and then just really make that sort of threat of activation is like a really powerful effect, and the fact that you can cheat him out with the kid plot is, you know, much better than having to pay 3 cost for him. And of course, with Stark Kohor being so powerful, a 3 cost attachment basically means you can tutor any attachment in your deck out. So there's definitely going to see play in Kohor decks, and he may see some play in other decks, depending on like a Stark Kill deck, like maybe that deck that AJ was in second place at US Nationals with, a kind of like tempo based Stark Kill deck. And he has a great advantage of the printed Shaggy Dog from the box is not all that great. So he's not competing with like Grey Wind or Summer or Nymeria, which are just fantastic board presence characters. So, you know, like Shaggy is good, but a little bit niche. And then Mirror Reed, if you can step away from just how busted this card was in first edition, in the context of second edition, she's really, really strong, but not quite as busted as she was in first. I think she's probably the most interesting Shadows card that's been printed. I think they actually hit the sweet spot between balance and power here. Particularly if you can set her up, she is going to be a constant pain in your opponent's behind. But I do think she does the kind of things that non-rush-based Stark really want. And what's interesting to me is I think it does a really good job of answering rush-based Stark by getting rid of that renown and being able to do it multiple times with an engine like Wyman in a turn to sort of shut down all the interesting things your opponent can do. She's one of the few characters that actually, though, the change to Shadows makes her weaker against things like Mace. Like if you in the old version of Shadows, if you were first player, you could bring Mira out of Shadows in the Shadows framework, and she would be able to blank Mace before Mace could be triggered. That, of course, no longer is the case with his blink ability, but she still is actually a pretty good answer to Mace, but not quite as good as she could be. But I really do like her. So I would say Stark here is at an A territory, with Mira being an S and Shaggy Dog being a B minus.
That was a good run. I was really hoping that I would be the one to throw out the difference with first edition and the Mace example in particular. You beat me to the punch. That said, I mean, she's still really efficient. Even just like baseline stats, like 2 cost, 2 icons, stealth body with an actual strength in second ed. I think even just on that, she's really strong. On top of everything with abilities and such, this is very much at the top end of efficiency in the Shadows abilities and effects that we've seen so far. So I think this is almost certainly going to be the most common Shadows card that we're seeing. And, good for Gualdo. Those champ cards, they want them to see play. I don't know that I have a whole lot more to add beyond that compared to Roy's rundown. Shaggy Dog, I think I'm a little higher on. I really like this because, you know, effectively, in a lot of ways, it's not just like a throwing axe equivalent, but it's almost a throwing axe in every challenge you initiate. You know, the restriction that this just has to be on a Stark character is pretty low, so Shaggy Dog's ability to just eliminate chump blocking, I think, is pretty high, which sounds pretty good for a number of Stark decks to just move surprisingly fast, even if they're not necessarily focused on killing. It's not the attrition that this Shaggy Dog could generate is not something a lot of decks could withstand for long, and so I think they just force a lot of unopposed. So I think I give Stark an A.
I don't really see the point in comparing Mirror to first edition. It's just a different card. I think it's severely underrated exactly how much Sack is in Stark. Maybe a mess or more is coming, but as of right now, it's really only Wyman. And I guess you can run Jon Snow, but it's mostly just Wyman, so he's going to have a hard time going back to Shadows reasonably often. It's not killed or sacked, it's just sacked. So as a one-time use, he's really good. I think one of his biggest applications is that Stark still can struggle against attrition if it doesn't get its draw going, and that kind of attrition really, really hates effects like Mirror. This is the second pack in a row that had a card that says, please don't play Varus anymore. Varus is functionally ejected forcefully from the meta between Breaking Ties, Mira, and Vince. So, given those three cards, good luck with Varus. Apparently, champs really hate Varus. So, that's fine. I think that makes for a less interesting game, but here we are. She's fantastic for what she is. Don't plan on getting 18 uses out of her, multiple uses per phase or anything else. Plan to use her once or twice, because any decent opponent's going to answer Wyman pretty quickly. And once Wyman is answered, if it's going to answer Wyman, you're just winning anyway. It doesn't matter if you have Mirror or not. But any decent opponent who can answer Wyman has functionally also answered your recursion of Mirror, your reusing of Mirror. Which is fine. I actually don't think it's an S card. I think it's an A card. I think it's maybe an A plus card. But that's good. I also don't think Shaggy Dog really has a home in current Stark. I don't think current Stark as a general sans, I guess, very specifically AJ's build, goes aggro. I think the mid-range decks are trying to play a tempo game and use that's the fact that they have literally everything the game can offer to win. And the rush decks don't really want a 3-cost attachment. So given that, well, I guess they want a 4-cost attachment, but that's a little different. But given those two factors, I don't see this having a great home right this minute. I think that home will eventually exist. I think Shaggy Dog will be a very strong card, because having one gold and being able to threat of activation with that, especially if you're running the Wardens of the North or anything similar in order to jump things in, is an incredibly strong play. Oh, I guess it also has a home. I don't know. I'm not 100% sure it has a home in a dedicated Dire Wolves deck. I'm not sure there's enough bodies there for it. But either way. Yeah.
So, a couple points. I think the amount of stand that's in Stark, and this sort of struck me as Aaron was talking to, though, means that like it's not difficult to get Shaggy Dog into three challenges with the move ability, right? Like if you have him on
three goals.
No, you can only move it once. But if one character, like you say, it starts the round on Wyman.
Say you're no one.
Right, you're no one. It starts on Sansa. I am no one. Right, she gets two challenges. And then you move it over to Rob, and now you have three challenges to Shaggy Dog for one gold. And that's a huge threat of act. That's like a huge problem for a lot of
people. Two gold, because I'm no one.
Right, I'm no one. But it could just be like Wyman, or it could be starts on Rob, sack through some way, or kill through some way, stand everybody, Rob into a challenge again, move over to somebody else. Like there's lots of different ways to get that kind of action economy in Stark. Like I just spent a weekend watching people play Stark, and the amount of stand and sort of synergy that's in Stark is super duper duper powerful. And I think Shaggy Dog does have the ability to get into three challenges without really changing what Stark already wants to do. And then you missed your favorite card in the game in relation to Mira, Aaron. Breaking Ties.
Yeah.
Breaking Ties gives a huge outlet with Flea Bottom for Mira, right? So you can bring her out of shadows, blank, sacrifice her as a way to get her off the board, and then bring another version out of shadows. Like there's lots of, and you can bring, and she's more good targets for Breaking Ties for Stark. Like I forget what game it was that I was watching that we were commenting on U.S. Nationals, but somebody heads on spiked, Summer, and there was just no other cheap loyal characters for that player that they were able to find for their Breaking Ties turn. They end up having to Breaking Ties Rob, right? So like another cheap good character you already want in your deck is going to just make Breaking Ties even more powerful in Stark. And also, of course, Breaking Ties energizes Mira.
So. Yeah, that's a good point. So I guess you have those two ways to use it, which still I don't think is more than maybe three or four. Regarding Shaggy Dog, yeah, I think it's really strong. I'm not sure the slot exists. Like a lot of those decks aren't running Ice, and I think Ice is probably just a strictly better card for most Stark builds.
That's almost certainly true. It's a better card, but Ice is one of the best attachments in the game.
Right, right. But if these Russian most mid-range decks aren't fitting ice, then you're not fitting Shaggy either, even with the search. Because most of the time, your search is still going to want to be summer.
Or Grey Wind. All right. You ready for the broken Tyrell card?
And then the really useless Tyrell card.
Our preview card, you mean?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's a zero-cost event, man. Darkwings, Dark Words.
Yeah, there we go. Keep looking to the future. We'll get there.
I guess Will's reading Tyrell.
I'm assuming.
Sure, can. All right. First up, we've got Sir Markham Molendor. He's a unique, non-loyal, 4-cost military and intrigue icons, 4 strength, reaction. And he's a knight. Reaction after you win a challenge in which Sir Markham Molendor is participating, reveal the top card of your deck. Put that card into play. If you do, place Sir Markham Molendor on top of your deck. Cannot be saved. Which is a nice addition there, I suppose. Then we have our preview card. That was Bonds of Chivalry. 0-cost, non-loyal event. Action, choose a participating knight character you control, stand it, and remove it from the challenge. Then you may kneel another knight character you control to have it participate in the challenge on your side. So I'll start with Bonds of Chivalry here. To very briefly recap, you can go double-check the latest episode of The Things I Do for Love, where we talked about it. It is a neat idea, a fun interactive Tyrell card that would have been very interesting and maybe seen some play in cycle 1 or 2, but has been left behind. Might still have some application in Melee, where knights are some good, and definitely could be a fun way to, sneak in a Lady Sansa's Rose or something. But overall, in competitive joust, this is not going anywhere right now. Then we've got Sir Mark Molendor. Wow. More top of deck manipulation, more pseudo card advantage, or at the very least, definitely gold advantage here with Mark. The key thing I think here to note, if you didn't, when on a quick read through this ability, he does not force you to trade him out. So if you reveal the top card and it's a garden caretaker, you don't have to trade Mark in for that. You can make certain you're saving him for your red mages, your mixes, whatever it might be. Which I think is going to be pretty easy to track down. They've got spies, they've got the septons, heck, people may go back to using Bear and the Maiden Fair regularly. You've got a lot of ways to manipulate the top card of their deck. And then you've got things like Spies and Old Town that care about the top card of your deck. So it's another way to verify what is on top of your deck to make certain you get your Old Town draw and power. He's a bigger guaranteed strength boost with a spy if you need to go that way. He has a lot of application here in card effects on top of just the fact that you are probably trading him out for 2 or 3 gold worth of econ advantage and action advantage, because you've just won a challenge with Mark and you're dropping a standing character in after that. Like, Mark does a lot of work, I think. Overall, between these two cards, I probably just give Tyrell a B, because Bonds of Chivalry is pulling them down. But Mark is really good.
So here we go. I think Mace is cycling out of the meta, so I'm less annoyed by Mark than I would be like a couple weeks ago, because I don't think that Mace decks are going to be able to stand up to the sheer onslaught of bullshit Stark is getting. Because, like, every card this cycle Stark has gotten has just been straight out balls, right? Like, it's just been completely amazing the cards Stark is consistently getting. And I feel like Stark has become Tyrell's natural predator and knocked them back a bit. That said, like, I don't think that was the design decision behind Mark. I think he's just kind of bad design. I don't like him. I don't like that he's printed. If Mace ever comes back, he's part of every Mace deck. He's probably only a one of. But, like, a one of that you can functionally guarantee a second trigger out of, for example, the Scheming Septon, and then still draw again by before the end of the turn is really freaking obnoxious. It's just, I don't like the design of him. I think he's perfectly fine right now, probably, but I really don't like his design. And I truly hope I'm right that Charlie's cycling out for a little while, because they've been good literally since Stalic last year. And I feel like 10 months of being on top of the game's probably pushing the limits of game health. Bonds of Chivalry, I don't care about, so I'm not going to talk about it. I'm just going to give the house a B-.
There you go.
The best thing that can be said about Mark is that he forces Mace decks to do challenges again. But the problem with that is probably in this Stark infested meta, you got to redesign your Mace decks to be more challenge proactive. And while I don't think Mace players have quite figured out what that looks like currently, when they do, Mark will be a key aspect of it, because I mean, you can just kind of go infinite with him and an Old Town Septon and Old Town, where, you know, you trigger the Old Town Septon, put it on top of the deck, put it into play, get him, draw him, get a power. Every turn, you just know that Mark's there, you know that a Septon is there, and you're just cycling them. Is as, and then that frees up a lot of other triggers.
Boring as shit, I think is what you're looking for here.
Yeah, it's boring as shit, but it can sort of set up an infinite chain that you just create additional consistency once you have Mace out.
Hey, I have a thought that you'll like, or hate, or I don't know, you're weird. But hey, how did Jesse lose those two games at Gen Con?
Not knowing what was on the top of his deck.
There you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, and he, if you can guarantee a 4 strength there with the Hightower Spy.
Yep. Oh, yeah. It sets up Hightower Spy plays. It sets
that's
up.
That's disgusting.
And also, like, Mace, I mean, Aaron and I spent a summer refining a Mace deck, so we know this. Actually, good red icons is actually something that Tyrell is missing right now, besides Renly and left and right. And so this adds a good red icon at a good strength point with an icon it wants green, because you've already got enough blue icons. So you add a decent, at affordable cost spot that actually he helps with setup. 4 is great for setup. Like, you will just at least see one or two of him, I think, in many decks, like Mace decks. And just, he's also, but he also like has some niche play in like, well, not niche play. He actually will definitely see play in Knights decks and sort of tier 2 start or Tyrell decks that are kind of like pushed down. It's kind of also interesting that he's kind of cool in the sense that he synergizes with any faction. So if he is part of a banner package, you get the card advantage or that card advantage, you get the sort of action advantage, no matter what it is. So it does say, hey, maybe there is some Tyrell Knights package that some other faction might want to pick up at some point. It's constantly been threatening that, but it's never quite happened.
Knights. Like, Scott would run this in his Martell Rose, right?
Probably. I mean, just getting new cards into play, right? Because it's any card, right? That's not an event, because you can't put events into play. Is, you know, just winning a challenge, awesome. Like, winning an intriguing challenge, awesome. Flip top card of your deck, okay. Putting Dorne into play, that's great, right? Like, it's just really just the economy advantage he gives you is just very, very strong. And yeah, so he's definitely an A card. I don't think he's an S card, because he has to be in challenges. If he didn't have to be in challenges, he would be an S card. I'm not as down on Bonds of Chivalry necessarily as you guys are,
just
because it's very boring. It's actually a little less boring because of the Ven part of it. So you can use it as a, like, fake a challenge, stand your character, get it out of the challenge, without having to put another Tyrell character in, or another Knight character, excuse me. So, like, that's kind of an interesting interaction that I kind of like, but it's still not, it's still an F card, but,
no,
you know,
it's not an F card, that's
D.
Crazy.
It's D.
I think D is reasonable.
Like, it's pretty funny with Gregor.
It is pretty funny with Gregor.
No, I love my Gregor bullshit decks.
So, And it's a zero cost event. Zero cost events are always dangerous. So so it's got to be a D. But it's on the lower end of D, for sure. But it's still better than the other. It's still Danny found a way to print a bad Tyrell card. So A plus D, Danny, for effort. So this is probably a B faction overall, thanks to the weight of Bonds of Chivalry. But definitely keep an eye on Sir Mark.
All right, I'm not reading Night's Watch, Royce.
All right, I can read Night's Watch.
Will, did you go on that?
Yeah.
Yeah, you read it. Okay.
All right. Oh, well, I'll read the Night's Watch cards. Jon Snow is a 7-cost, the first loyal version of Jon for Night's Watch. He has all 3 icons. He has 6 strength. He is a bastard, commander, and lord. While you control a builder character, Jon Snow gains stealth. While you control a ranger character, Jon Snow gains intimidate. Steward character, Jon Snow gains insight. And then we have Lord Commander, which is a non-loyal 3-cost attachment. It's a title, Night's Watch character with printed cost 5 or higher only. Reaction, after you win a challenge in which you control a participating Night's Watch character, attached character gains 1 power. There's some cool things. Like, these are cool cards. There's some fun things with Lord Commander, where if you have the new wall out, all of your opponent's characters become Night's Watch characters, so you can put it on your opponent's cards, which I think is kind of funny. But, you know, there's going to be some Shaga, Jon Snow, Lord Commander deck, some version of Jon. It could be any of the Jon. Well, it can't be the 6-cost Jon from the box, but either the 7-cost in the Night's Watch box or this Jon. Or maybe even the old bear. I still don't think... I think 3-cost for... For kind, I don't know, like pseudo renown. I don't know. It's a lot.
It's better than renown. But
it's way better than
renown. It is better than renown. But the problem is, like, Night's Watch is like the other Jon is very vulnerable to breaking ties. The old bears are kind of bad. This Jon is not as good as I would hope he would be. But there are some cool things with him. Like I just don't like any of these Night's Watch cards. Like. There's some cool things you can do with this Jon Snow, and I like that he's immune to breaking ties, but I still, he's just so much gold. And I don't know. And you're going to most consistently get Intimidate and Insight, which is pretty powerful, but he doesn't have a lot of action economy. So you're just getting like 1 challenge out of him. I don't know. I think this is like a C+ Night's Watch pack. Like, I really don't have strong opinions about any of this. It's like really cool to put the 0-cost attachment on this Jon that gives him all the traits, but like that's just a bad card.
I mean, there's also the easiest way in the world to do that, right? It's not like there's not an agenda that just goes and grabs that for you.
That's true.
And like there's probably a deck that is relatively similar to Jim's Crossing. Jim played a Night's Watch Crossing to top 4 at Will's Nationals. It's posted on Throne CB if you want to see it. He wrote a ridiculously crazy amount about it because, you know, Jim Henson, ladies and gents. But there's a deck that's similar to that, but not that deck, that runs this Jon and Lord Commander out of Kohor. And I'm not sure it's bad. Like, it might just be like, because if you get this Jon Snow with this stupid attachment, and then the 1-cost attachment, which again with Kohor is not a hard setup, and you at the gates for Amon, like you're in reasonable shape going forward. Like you're gonna gain a lot of power really fast, and it's not like that makes it's not like ice is not ice. Longclaw is no longer available. It's not like Ren is no longer available. There's just suddenly an awful lot of options. I don't like this Jon Snow. I think that might be literally the only home I can really think of for him. But I do like Lord Commander. I'm not sure Lord Commander is good. I think it's, like, new wall decks are slow and hard to gain power. Like, if they don't get the lock, you're just playing these long, grindy games that you tend to, like, lose on time because you couldn't get anything going. But if you can get one of their 5-cost characters and start stacking power on them, that seems like a really, really good way to help those decks. I don't know if they can fit them. I don't know if they're going to run them, but it's at least interesting. I think Jon is mediocre, and I think Lord Commander is kind of secretly great, and it might take a while to break, but it's going to break.
I mean, John's obviously a shotgun card, right? He's designed for a player opening the pack to look at and go, oh, wow, like, what could I do? Like, just to kind of get wheels turning. I think he'll be interesting, and I think maybe there might be something that tinkers with that. I think you mentioning Jim's deck in regard to these cards. I think maybe a version would look at Lord Commander, but probably not Jon Snow. But I do really like your thought about this Lord Commander maybe making a spot in new wall decks, because they're obviously so dependent on what they pick up from the opponent in regards to closing out the game. And sure, maybe you run up against a Stark deck and you luck into, you know, Eddard and Rob and company for the renown, but maybe you don't. And I think I really like the thought that Lord Commander here really evens out the, like, power earning potential of the kind of random characters that you're getting out of the new wall. So I think there may be something there.
I mean, if you added, like, let's say you pull someone, like, you pull Randall, and you're never going to find a way to stand him because your deck doesn't do that, right? But, like, now you're just getting renown plus this constantly. You're getting probably at least 3 power per challenge phase counting as renown, if not 4. And that's just going to close things really
well. And it's not on attack only. It's participated at all. So, like, I mean, it would kind of be...
Oh, wow, I didn't realize that.
Like, it would kind of be Magical Christmas Land. But you could potentially get 6 power in a phase off of just the Lord Commander.
Right. Only counting 3, because it's not hard. Like, so the main problem new wall decks have right now, right, is they're kind of glacially slow.
Glazerly?
In the sense that, like...
Yeah, glazerly.
Yeah, glazerly slow. So, like, they can get sort of an insurmountable advantage on an opponent, but, like, it can take 90 minutes for them to actually get to 15 power, and, like, you often will see new wall decks, like, lose on time to, like, 8 to 10 because they were at 0 for the first 35 minutes of the game, but then just sort of ground their opponent into dust, but couldn't get up to the power. But Lord Commander does give those decks a tool, particularly because in the meta, unless you're in a new wall mirror, there's not a lot of ways for them to steal the characters back. And then most of the theft back doesn't come in the form of, like, ward style effects. And this can't even be warded. Where, so if they do get the character back, it's because it went back into the discard pile or went into the dead pile for some reason. So they're not going to get that power that you accumulate on the character if something bad happens to it. So the give new wall decks more breathing room is definitely sort of the most immediate place that Lord Commander slots in. I still am a little worried in non-cohort decks for a 3-cost attachment. I mean, it's the same problem with this Jon Snow. Like, if you look at Jim's Night's Watch deck, it's not running 7-cost Jon, who is one the from the Night's Watch box, who's an amazing rush card. He's just so expensive. And the question is, like, I'm not sure if one Night's Watch is Rush's advantage over other Rush decks right now is it's the lowest to the ground of all of those Rush decks, except maybe Greyjoy, but Greyjoy still runs, like, the big boys because they have renown and swingy effects. But it's definitely closer to the ground than the Stark deck is, and that kind of gives you an advantage. You can do much more on low gold and all kinds of stuff. But this Jon just kind of clogs that up, just like the non-loyal 7-cost Jon from the box does. So I'm afraid that while he might be an awesome Shaga card, he's just going to end up being binder fodder. But Lord Commander definitely has potential, and definitely this conversation has sort of rekindled that potential to me.
I didn't read it, so just while we're here, I'm going to give them a B-. Maybe a C+. I'm going to give them a C+.
You going to do Baron Al Glazer?
Yeah.
Did everyone rate?
I've gone twice. You refuse to do Night's Watch, so.
Yeah, no. Did everyone rate? I said not read.
Oh, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, I did rate it, yep.
All right. Shireen Baratheon. 3 for 2 power icon. Faction Baratheon, which, you know, the name. Lady, Shadow 3. During a challenge in which Shireen is participating, choose a participating character. That character and Shireen do not contribute their strength to the challenge. Limit once per challenge. Privileged position. Event cost 1 loyal, unlike Shireen, and Shireen should really be loyal, but whatever. Play only if you have not lost a power challenge this round. Interrupt. When the effects of an opponent's event or triggered location ability would initiate, cancel those effects. Privileged position is phenomenal. Like, a truly phenomenal card that should go in most para decks basically immediately. Thankfully, it's not Valor, because then it would just be completely ridiculous. But even as is, the ability to cancel events is always great, especially since it's a set one cost, so you don't have to worry about any X bullshit. And, you know, you shouldn't be losing too many power challenges, and we'll talk about how Shireen makes it freaking half impossible to lose power challenges shortly. And you can fairly easily choke the living crap out of your opponent. Like, I'm very curious to see if a Barra Winter deck has any legs with this, especially given, you know, cards we'll get to later. Because, like, just being able to say, I don't care about your Great Hall at the right time is an extremely powerful proposition. Let alone, like, if you can avoid losing a power challenge, being able to just, like, shut off either wall. It's real, real good. And then Shireen's fantastic. Let's ignore that you can give her icons and basically not count strength for anything. She's on the board. If your opponent doesn't have stealth, it means that they must use at least 2 characters for any power challenge, which is great with the smaller boards of the current game. But even without that, like, let's say you power challenge with her, they now have to, assuming you have the red keep out, they now have to defend with 2 people, because the red keep's 2 strength would still count, and you would still win that challenge despite neither character having any participation. I think Shireen is freaking phenomenal in multiple houses. I think she's an amazing Martell card. I think she's an amazing Stark card. I think she's an incredible Lannister card, especially because Lannister can so easily give her an intrigue icon so she can shut that shit down too. I love these cards. I think Barra's an A right now.
Yeah, this is definitely A's. So the fact that Shireen gives Barra an answer to Small Theon is very good. Small Theon, in my experience, was like a really, really big problem for Barra decks, particularly if you're running the Red Keep. And the fact that Shireen can go over them is very good. It helps just. She just helps smooth out a lot of some of the problems that Barra has, and she's a great utility character. And then privileged position is busted. The fact that you have this location and event cancel for 1 gold that sits until the first challenge is initiated, at least, but the fact that it goes through the plot phase, the draw phase, and the marshalling phase is ridiculous. And the fact that it's only 1 gold and it's loyal. So, I mean, this means a bear, like, this makes a bear, honest to goodness, makes a bear fealty build much more appealing. Is just crazy. Like, this is a Martell player's dream card. And these are definitely tools that Barra wanted. This is an A pack for Barra. I mean, Shireen is like kind of like a B minus card, but privileged position is like A or E or even S tier. Like, it's the strongest cancel that Danny's printed in a while. I think it's probably, as a cancel of events, stronger than Someone Always Tells. Now, of course, I'm not talking about canceling plot effects, but I'm talking about, like, as an event cancel, this is much stronger. And we're starting to see more interesting events come back into the meta with the return of Put to the Sword, the return of Put to the Torch. And this is a huge boon to Barra, because, like, Barra doesn't really lose power challenges. So.
You know, I like both of these cards. Again, I think I'm kind of in a position where we've been reviewing these cards together for so long that the last person maybe has less to say about them, other than I'll throw out there that Shireen is another let's say, maybe Waste of Shadows, like, she's not worth 5 gold, I don't think, if you shadows her. But at 3, I really like her. So she's another one where that will be markedly less useful, aside from maybe some application with the card we'll talk about later. Privileged position, though. I mean, I really like this card, but I do think maybe that you guys are underplaying the ability for other factions to play around this. Like, you know, against Baratheon, at least if you have stuff you want to do during the challenge phase, that you can reprioritize the power challenge first in order to be able to activate other stuff. And, you know, obviously it depends a little bit about who you are, what you're doing, but there are definitely factions that can do that with minimal impact. We've been talking about Stark a lot. It's very minimal for them to prioritize winning that power challenge and then standing everybody up and continuing to do whatever else they want to do. Like, this is the only one of these cancels. As much as I like it, and as excited as I am to see it in Baratheon, it's the only one of these, you know, treacheries and the like, that has an direct off switch for the opponent, let's say. They don't need to remove enough characters from your board. They remove your only, you know, unique Lannister. They don't need to have 2 gold and a hand's judgment to cancel your someone always tells, something like that. Like, they just need to win a power challenge. I think it is a lower bar than you guys are making it out to be.
Yeah, I mean, hold on. So Targaryen, right? We're missing this, right? Because traditionally one of the worst matchups for Baratheon is Targ, right? I mean, this has been the case since...
Hey, time out. You better ask Ibri about that.
Sure.
I can't remember?
Oh, where they made the bet about who would do better and Barra did better than they did?
And yeah. Barra beat them. No. It was that Targ would win 10 games and then Barra won 11 games.
So, but traditionally... Targaryen beats Baratheon. In fact, when Barra's been on the rise again, Targ has a tendency to do well again. And a lot of the power in non-crossing builds for Targ, particularly we're going to see a future Targ card down here that really pushes this, is in the events, right? And those events generally require the character to be in the challenge, or the really powerful one, the 2-cost one, that doesn't need to be in challenges. Like, you can hold off a power challenge, and then that turns off until they win a power challenge. That turns off their ability to easily Dracarys you, Consuming Flames you, A Dragon Is No Slave you. These are powerful swingy cards against for Targaryen against Barra that just get turned off until they can win a power challenge. And you can stop them from winning that power challenge because now they can't Dracarys you. And you can cancel Astapor, and you can cancel their Marine.
I haven't seen Astapor in like 2 months.
I know, but I'm just saying, or you can cancel their Flea Bottom with this. Like, it gives, I think, Privileged Position in particular is really good answer for one of Barra's traditionally bad matchups. It just seems, that feels to me at least, to constantly get worse. With Paws of Pride, right? Like, it's this, for 1 gold, you can trade evenly in economy. You can always trade evenly with card, but you can trade evenly with economy as well because it's 1. Or in the case of a Dragon as a Slave, have an economic advantage because you paid 1 gold and a card for their 2 gold.
Or consuming.
Consuming, you got what? A card, a gold, and then 2 other cards?
Another card.
So,
I think
that alone is a huge reason for this card to be powerful.
I mean, I think a lot of those are good examples, but it also dictates that the Baratheon player has to use it then, like during that power challenge on that Flames or whatever. They can't bank it for some other opportune situation, because if they do not use it for that power challenge, they can't play it the rest of that round. And I think that type of forced restriction is definitely going to have an impact.
So does forcing them to do the power challenge first, though, right?
Sure, sure. And I'm saying these are kind of cumulative things. There's a lot of considerations, but even something like the Flea Bottom example, like going back to just the basic Flea Bottom Second Sons, like they're probably winning the power challenge if you let them get the Second Sons back. So you basically have to blow a privileged position on it, or you can't.
I don't think that's true, right? Like, I feel like I can just, like, for example, Shireen, and not give any kind of shit about your Second Sons. But beyond that fact that I could just win it anyway, like, the second most popular, if not the most popular agenda right now is Lords of the Crossing. And being able to force them to make that power challenge versus that negative one is completely amazing.
That's a good point.
Like, there's a lot of hidden little benefits here. Being able to say, like, you want to trigger Kohor, and now you have to jump into my biggest challenge first if you want to try and, like, get everything going here is really good. Like, I think earlier I said I think that Drell is on the downswing. I think Bear is just as good as, like, at least Lannister and Night's Watch, if not quite as good as your top, very, very top houses right now. Like, as long as those mace decks aren't everywhere, I think Targ doesn't really have bad matchups. Farrah doesn't really have bad matchups. I think we may have to discuss that again, given the Greyjoy card a couple down. But for the time being, like, I think Farrah's right there. I think that deck that Matt came in for at the Nationals with is the real deal. The same deck. It's the exact same deck, I think. Maybe one or two cards different that knocked me out of the Fracas, where I got smoked by a lot of extra control and a lot of stand and a lot of power effects. And there's not a lot that, like, most factions can do about that. Like, assuming that they're running Kohor, they can handle your Catelyns or your Wymans, and they don't really have a bad matchup. Like, it's King in the North that gives them a good amount of draw. Privileged Position stops anyway. You're stopping their King in the North trigger, basically. Like, there's some good Baradex there right now, and I think that these cards slot into them fairly quickly.
I think that's also a good point, though, about... So I definitely agree. Will's example of sort of, like, Stark is the... Like, Targaryen is the best-case example for this card, and Stark's the worst.
Sure.
But I feel like Privileged Position... its ability to cancel Winterfell is a very important thing, and also there's this and I am no one as well that
and
they often
winter is coming
and winter well winter is coming like if you really want to get your winter is coming and often against Barra you're going for that to that like blowout mill play you know you're going to still have to
if you're opening for a blowout mill play to get your winter is coming like you usually make that mill first to make everything easier to get through. You go heavy on mill, you play winter is coming, you haven't powered yet, which means right. My privileged position works.
So I'll make one last point about this, because I do think that this Barra is really important. So what I've noticed in in our King in the North meta, and I actually think that King of the North is probably the card that's most shaping the meta in many ways, besides maybe Wars to Come, maybe Crossing, but it's still there. A lot more interaction is having on the event level, and the ability for Barra to continue to cover its ass, particularly the Matt's deck, the Barra Kohor Rose, which gets a lot of really good use out of King of the North.
You mean Hanno's deck, but okay.
Hanno's deck, yeah, but the one Matt was last playing. Like its ability to cover its King of the North on the one level of interaction that every faction has on a King of the North turn is a huge deal. Because particularly on that, it's a difficult turn for your opponent to win a power challenge if they don't have a King out for Barra. So I think that if it continues to cover a Barra weakness on a key turn is why Privileged Position, I think, is like clearly an A card. It's actually kind of pushed it to an S tier card the more I talk about it here, but it's an A.
Will, did you rate it?
You know, I don't think I actually rated Barra. I'm having a hard time on this one. I think Shireen is pretty good. I think Privileged Position is good in theory, but I'm less convinced about practice, but we don't need to rehash that. So I think maybe overall I give Barra like a B+ out of this pack. All right, on to Lannister. First up, we have Tithe Collector. This is a non-loyal 3-cost, 3-strength character with an intrigue icon. It has ally and the 7, And reaction, after you collect income, pay 2 gold to have the Tithe Collector gain 1 power, plus 1 gold. Then we've got an event. I've seen this one before. This is Clever Feint. It's 0 cost and non-loyal. And action, kneel your faction card to choose any number of cards you control with Shadow. Return each of those cards to Shadows. These are interesting cards that I like as seed cards, but I don't really think that either one is particularly great at the moment. The Tithe Collector, I do wonder about Lannister now. We've got 2 new non-limited sources of income, which I'm really a fan of. I doubt paying 2 gold for that power with that kind of forced once a turn timing on a non-unique 3 cost, very vulnerable character is going to be great. But I have been really curious about kicking around some Faith Militant out of Lannister, and really they needed some in-house 7 to give that a shot. And so now I think I might be willing to give that another go. See if I've got a critical mass now to make that happen. Clever Feint, on the other hand, again, is a seed card. You know, right now I can toss back a Sir Robert Strong, which is going to be awesome, and theoretically a Cat's Paw, which is turning out to be worse in practice than I had hoped for. But I still think we're just going to need more cards that really actually use Shadows for some reason, you know, coming out of play to do something, for Clever Feint to have an impact. We have not seen cards come out in the packs to back the excitement I had when I first saw Clever Feint spoiled. So, you know, overall, geez, can I give the Lannister faction an E right now? I feel like that's where I am.
Yeah, I don't see why not. I mean, that makes a fair amount of sense to me.
I mean, Clever Feint is going to be straight up broken at some point, right? Like, as a non-loyal, zero-cost event that returns a powerful Shadows effect. Like, it's just any number of Shadows cards, right? So if you can get 2 or 3 good Shadows cards that have really powerful coming to effect, like Aegon level or Mira level Shadows abilities, like, 0 gold to reset all that is extremely powerful, like, and definitely worth a faction card, Neil. And it's non-loyal, which basically it's very, very powerful. And, you know, it might not be super powerful right now, but we have this cycle and presumably another cycle based on what Danny said when the bestow cards came out.
of 4 months out.
Yeah. Right. But we have at least another cycle of Shadows cards, which mean, and, you know, knowing the way Danny did with Bestow, he's going to push it even harder in the next cycle. Like, there's powerful cards, like just the ability of a Lanny Dragon deck to reuse Aegon. And what's the kill? Sir Robert Strong. Like, that's really powerful. And then, like, Tithe Collector is also non-loyal, which is really interesting to me. Like, is this the first time they printed passive power as a non-loyal effect?
Ooh, that's...
I guess it would be Chamber would be the other one, but at least you have to win Dominance.
And, you know, there's arguments to be made that Dominance is kind of a fourth challenge. So this is more passive than Chamber is, for sure.
I mean, I don't necessarily think a Tyrell Lion deck would be good, but sometimes Maze decks are 1 power short in a critical turn. You know, they're at that Mace can get you to 14 power that turn. Well, Tithe Collector can get you to 15 for 2 gold. And
I almost wish
it's not difficult to avoid that.
So you're saying more power is good.
A slightly less restrictive thing. If it said something like after you add gold to your gold pool or something along those lines, to maybe hook into some of the other Lannister effects to gain gold in the challenge phase or something. I mean, there's still an upward upwards.
I don't know. That's really strong, Will. Like, that means like you could pay 2 gold. That means basically, if you can do 2 intrigue challenges, you get 2 power with Tyrion. Right, core Tyrion, right?
Yeah.
If they printed it that
way.
But
it also means you can't spend that to ambush the Hound or, you know, whatever else it might be.
Right, but I mean, we've already seen how dangerous, like, Mace is and the ability to, like, chain that plus it would, other gold.
Like, it would still hook it into challenges. At that point, it's not really passive, right? Like, it's requiring back and forth challenges.
That's definitely passive.
And well, and then also, like, I mean, we shouldn't begrudge, like, we shouldn't go too far down this, but also turns the Lannister, both the 2 Lannister econ locations that generate gold in the challenges phase into opportunities to pay 2 gold and get power.
I love it.
Well, I mean, I love it too. You know, I love the kind of passive power nonsense, but like, Mace has already shown, I don't think we're ever going to get a passive power effect as powerful as Mace. And Mace has already shown how dangerous he can be and how he can distort the game around that. I think Tithe Collector is printed at about as much as you can push this effect in a post-mill Mace world. And I would not be surprised if he sees some play eventually. But he's definitely... I agree with you, Will. This is actually an E faction with Clever Feint being, I think, the closest to immediately playable.
Sure. Aaron, any thoughts?
I think Tithe Collector is the kind of card I like least in the game. So, hi, Tithe Collector. Thanks for coming, I guess. Please don't stay. I think that it's probably got a home somewhere with something stupid and broken and passive. I don't know where that is. I don't like it. I mean, it's also non-limited economy that's fairly solid, so I can see it being in a fair amount of Lannister decks. Here being able to win in the Lanny doesn't have a 7 build, right?
I mean, not yet that I've been able to put together, but I think that now that we actually have something in house, plus whatchamacallit, the book that makes someone 7, like I think that it's worth taking a look at again. I'll let you know what I tinker with.
I could see that. So in a 7 build, this is going to be really, really great because it sets up an awful lot of good things that you want in that deck. I don't know. I hate the card, but it's probably good. Clever Feint's fucking phenomenal. It's not ready yet, but once Lannister hits a critical mass of Shadows cards, like Roy said, this is going to be completely incredible. I don't know when that critical mass happens, but given that they got a Shadows location and everything else, I'm assuming that that critical mass will be pushed, even if it's going to take a year and the game might die before then. I'm assuming that that's going to actually happen. I think Clever Feint is... I mean, they're both E cards. I'm just giving him an E. Clever Feint's going to be an A eventually, and I hope Tithe Collector remains an E.
Okay.
We ready for another busted card?
Sure.
All right. Victarion Greyjoy. He is a loyal, thank goodness. 7 cost... Red, blue icon, 7 strength character, captain, ironborn, lord, challenges action, kneel a warship location 2, choose one, choose and kneel a location, stand Victarion Greyjoy, have Victarion Greyjoy gain renown until the end of the challenge. Grey Ghost is a non-loyal 2 cost shadows location, shadow 2. Action, kneel Grey Ghost to choose 1 character, 2 characters instead of Grey Ghost, came out of shadows this phase. Until end of the phase, that each chosen character cannot be declared as a defender. Both of these cards are really strong. Grey Ghost is kind of only of a lower power level because Victarion is busted. It's really strong and continues to push unopposed. It may revitalize unopposed, particularly maybe a rush build that's built around unopposed. It's definitely worth the 4 gold investment. But of course, you don't have to invest the 2 gold, or you can just invest 2 gold and get the choose one character. And since boards are very small these days, this effect is even more powerful. And of course, if you can get the shadows ability off, particularly say off the first turn, thanks to setup, very, very strong. Victarion I just don't even know what to say about this card other than he's just really, really good. He's so many. There's plenty of Greyjoy warships that don't need to kneel. And there's also the zero cost warship, which is great on setup on turns when you need the strength pump. They're great, but also they cost zero and are warships, and you don't miss them to kneel them for Victarion triggers. He has no limit. So if you have, you can trigger this three times if you have warships. You know, he is a even, he's a seven cost Halder that does crazier stuff than Halder does. And Halder is one of the most busted cards without a limit in the game. So while you definitely get a lot of for your seven gold, and they had to print a strong card to compete with one of the best six cost characters in the game, this Victarion is way overpushed. He is probably S tier or A, highest of A's. And then Grey Ghost is a nice solid like B, B plus card. So I would give this faction an A. Vic is busted. He just doesn't have a limit. And it's just so strong.
Yeah. Yeah. That was kind of my reaction. I was kind of flabbergasted on seeing this Victarion kneeling out locations. I think at least at this level of open-endedness is going to be a very, very strong tool for Greyjoy. Add his kind of challenge prowess on top of that. Incredibly versatile. The only thing I can, slight caveat is they're maybe pushing so many great Greyjoy characters at the seven cost slot that it might get awkward for them from an income perspective, that I think you're gonna have to make some choices on which direction you go there. But Victarion is going to be an extremely good choice on that front. Grey Ghost, just extremely efficient in a lot of ways. It's a better pike, which is already like pretty good. This gives a stronger effect, kind of a permanent stealth on a particular character, or sorry, against a particular character, I should say, on top of having a more favorable trait, which could, in a pinch, do something with somebody like Victarion. I think it's very good, and it's going to be insane in Melee. I know, I'm bringing up Melee, but, you know, things like Salt Wives and Pikes are already so strong in Melee. The Grey Ghost is going to slot right in and be seen all over in any deck that touches Greyjoy. So I love that, since I love playing Greyjoy in Melee. So I'm going to give Greyjoy as a whole probably an A+ this pack.
So Greyjoy Crossing, which does not run a low gold curve, it's still a good stuff deck. Just won German Nats, literally like a couple days ago. Sorry, my computer's dying. My plug fell out. I didn't realize it. It just won German Nats. This card slots in at least a one of, maybe a two of. It's completely incredible. Completely incredible with things like Sea Stone Chair. It's just massively all around fantastic in an awful lot of situations.
Can I say something real quick? I just looked this up. Sea Bitch, one of the best warships in the game. Guess, does it kneel or does it not kneel? It doesn't kneel. Great Kraken also doesn't kneel.
Very good. In the meantime, Victarion is busted. If he becomes a constant force in the meta, then we can just wave goodbye to Waldex, right? Like, wall decks are no longer a thing that are playable in any way, shape, or form, because, like, you better be seeing those veteran builders, right? Like, otherwise, it's just help and good luck. And, like, you can also kneel your flea bottom, so, you know, further good luck with your vet builders.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that it's not tied to winning a challenge or something, you know, you vet builder in, stand it up, well, then you just kneel it. And oftentimes you're going to end up winning those exchanges, particularly when you are running warships that don't kneel to do their powerful effects. Or if they do kneel, like again, the zero cost one, it's not a huge tempo hit for you. ridiculous. Like, such a powerful card. And he's 7 strength.
Ugh. Yeah. I mean, they are not kidding about pushing this kind of thing. Like, this Victarion, I mean, like, if you want to run Greyjoy location control and just, like, mid-rangey usual good stuff, it's there. If you want to run Greyjoy as a, whatchamacallit, Greyjoy as a rush house, like, all those stands and renown seem real, real good. Like, he invents new deck types. He's completely phenomenal. In a pack with a mirror read, I think he might be the best card in the pack. And, well, at least the best character in the pack. And that's really saying something. And I think Grey Ghost is truly phenomenal, and I don't know why I'm not running one in basically every Greyjoy deck. So, what a card like Grey Ghost does is it makes me not defend a challenge because I go, what's the point sometimes? And then I can just use it to stand Victarion because, like, you didn't defend the challenge I wanted unopposed. Now I've got all that extra stuff going on. All of that is just phenomenal. And I think this is an S house. I think Greyjoy was probably back before now. Thanks, Vince. But, like, it's 1,000% back now. Like, all versions.
So, real quick, I just double-checked on ThronesDB. There are 5 warships that have effects that don't kneel. And then, of course, Refurbished Hulk was spoiled, which is a warship that is the 2-cost non-limited economy card that still produces its economy when it's knelt. Be prepared to play against this Vic a lot.
I have to.
Probably so.
Yeah. That you're just going to be happy that Dorne doesn't kneel, Aaron.
I mean, it kneels, right? Like, it's just nothing happens when it kneels.
Okay. Who is grabbing Targ?
I am. Targ's first card is a loyal dragon. It is Rhaegal. Military injury icons, 5 cost, 4 strength. Ambush 5 and no attachments. After an opponent's character is killed by a card effect, stand Rhaegal. And then the Myrinese Market, which is a 2-cost loyal Targ location. It is their non-limited econ. And its action is kneel Myrinese Market to choose a card in a discard pile and place it at the bottom of its owner's deck. Myrinese Market is going to be the most underrated card in this pack. I think it's a 3-up in every Targ deck until the end of time. It's completely phenomenal. They don't have to run Isle of Ravens. They run a couple of shuffle deck effects.
Yep.
And they're just set forever. I think it is a utterly, utterly fantastic card that people are not thinking enough about how completely it changes the game. Because if this is in 3-up in every Targ deck and Targ is constant in the meta, can you effectively run Flea Bottom any longer? And if you can't run Flea Bottom any longer, what are the ripple effects throughout the game thereafter? That's a really long conversation that we're not going to get into right now. But I think Myrinese Market has at least potential for that should people use it properly. And spoiler, use it properly. You're hearing how good it is. Play it. It's unbelievable. The fact that you can just be like, all right, so I'm going to get rid of everything that's a threat in your discard pile and get all my burn back, then shuffle my deck so I can replay all my burn, shuffle, it's really, really ridiculously good. Rhaegal, I'm less sure on. I think he's really good. I think he's at an awkward cost slot for Targ. That he's repeatable Drac is obviously fantastic. That he's got that ridiculous threat of activation is obviously fantastic. That he works with either what's their stupid name, Miri or New Danny are also truly excellent. He also works, I believe, with Blood of the Dragon, which is nice. But all of these different things are nice. I'm not sure they're better than just a nice 3-for-3 no attachments guy. He's really good. I'm not 1,000% sure Targ decks can afford him where their gold curve is right now. Like, because I think he's strictly worse than Kotho, who's one of the better cards in the game. I think he's strictly worse than Danny, who's one of the better cards in the game. I'm not 1,000% sure he's better than Aggo in every deck. Like, it's just, it's going to be, he's got a home. I just don't think his home is as widespread as people are currently making it seem because, yo, cool new dragon. But he's also got really good icon. Like, he's a very, very strong, very impressive card. that I'm happy saw print. I just don't think he's quite top tier, quite as good as the, at least two other five rosters that Targ has. And I don't think he shines a candle to the Miranese market, which is utterly fantastic. Probably the best non-limited econ we've seen, if not the Stark one.
Well, I'm a little bit more bullish on Rhaegal for a couple reasons. First, I agree with everything Aaron said about Miranese market. Targ will just have to figure out which shuffle effects it wants to run, which will be interesting to see what they do. So Rhaegal's ambush ability and existing at the same time as Hisdar makes him super interesting. And it makes, of course, this character cost 2 in the challenges phase alongside whatever Dracarys is. An advantage that Rhaegal has over other 5-cost characters in a Targ slot is that he's loyal, unlike Quotho and unlike some of the other characters that Targ has been running these days. It might push them more towards fealty, particularly if burn really becomes like a central Targ strategy, that challenge phase reduction could be really good, particularly when combined with Hisdar and things like that. So like a Hisdar Dany based burn deck that uses Rhaegal can be really powerful. And, you know, those kind of decks can people could say, well, how, if I get rid of the 3-cost Rhaegal, how am I going to trigger Dracarys? Well, this Rhaegal gives you an even better, you know, you don't have to burn a Plaza of Pride to stand your dragon and things like that. So I think this Rhaegal will see play. I think he'll see play in burn decks. I don't think he's necessarily quite a good enough good stuff card to just sort of be slammed 3x in every Targ deck. But I think he's going to see, I'm a little bit above Aaron on this. I think that this Rhaegal is like a B card. And he's a little bit more niche than maybe people initially in the Facebook group are giving to him, but not quite as niche as Glazer is making it out to be.
I don't think crossing decks run him. And I think Wars decks have a real decision to make, which is, I think, the last thing I really have to say about that. Also, I didn't rate the house, and Marine is a C, Rhaegal's a B minus, so I'm going to go A.
Well, that was a different direction than I expected you to go with the two individual grades for the overall. Didn't think you normally just added them. You know, whatever works.
I mean, yeah. Why not?
No, I think I definitely have to join the chorus of Miranese market. They keep kind of outdoing themselves, so to speak, every time I see another one of these non-limited income locations. I keep thinking, you know, more and more, oh, this one, you know, fits this faction so well and you know, is going to be so awesome and such a strong movie. And each one seems to do it better than the last. So I'm a little terrified. Do we still have any left to see? Let's see, the Tyrell one. I'm worried about what we're going to see with the Tyrell one. But Miranese Market is so great because it also saves you on deck slots compared to some other ones that have good effects but are not just strictly stapling two effects together that this house is already using in different cards. So I think that that's going to be huge and make it see play virtually forever, like Aaron said. Rhaegal, I think, is going to be good. I think it is probably one where the initial hoopla on the internet was higher than it probably needed to be in the end. But it's another strong stand effect in a faction that really likes having that action advantage. In a deck that's not necessarily trying to pump Stormborn Dany for some reason, I think this Rhaegal is a pretty easy option at very least a 1x. So I think I'm relatively high on him. Overall, I'd probably give Targ probably a minus in this house. Yeah, A minus. There we go.
One Smartell.
Yeah.
I think it's Will.
Oh, back to me already? Okay. Well, there we go. We've got...
Because Aaron read Targ, right?
Yeah, did in fact read Targ.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Just didn't feel like it should be back to me reading that fast, but that's probably just because I'm tired. So, first up, we've got House Manwoody Guard. This one is a non-unique, non-loyal character. He is 4 cost, 3 strength, has military and intrigue icons. He has the Guard and House Manwoody traits. While you are not the first player, each Guard character you control does not kneel when declared as a defender. And then we've got a kind of funky event. We've got a mission in Essos, which is going to be a Shadows loyal event with the dash cost. So that, of course, means it cannot be played normally. Must be Shadows. It has Shadows 2 and action. Remove all but the bottom card of your deck from the game face down. Then shuffle your discard pile into your deck and draw 3 cards. So first up, I'm going to hit the event, which is very funky and weird. It's worth, you know, kind of reminding people it removes them from the deck. It doesn't discard. You don't have a discard pile after you're done with this. So you're not opening up any shenanigans there. Okay, so basically you're looking to assemble some specific combo out of the cards that you're putting back on top of your deck, right? Like, either you are drawing in such an insane amount, admittedly possible, but in such an insane amount that you've got to use this just to reset your deck so you don't lose by decking yourself, or you're specifically putting a combo together in some means to use this to draw. And I'm not super big on either one of those. I think this is probably, the realistic rating for what we're doing is probably an E, but I feel like it's maybe actually an F until it's busted. One of those cards is going to be very off until it is extremely on and we have to have some variety of FAQ update. House Manwoody Guard, on the other hand, is just kind of an interesting, kind of generic, non-unique character here. This is the type of thing I keep feeling like I'm seeing Danny's magic roots come out, particularly in Martell, but where these characters kind of stack together on a trait or a creature type in Magic. And he doesn't have a lot of other options available in the pool. I mean, we got Hota, I guess, but, you know, mainly I want to get rid of him so that I can be ambushing him anyway. The Sandstake Snuff stuff is not coming together, so Nymeria's Guard's not there. Palace Spearman hasn't seen play in I don't know how long. And that's basically it, so, other than himself, of course. And at the high power level that Martell is at right now, I just don't know any of them that want to take time off for this kind of vanilla character. Maybe he helps you stall out for your Doran's game, but I think there are just other cards I would rather have in that deck. So Martell in this pack, I'm actually pretty down on. I'm going to give them guards a C, the other card. So I'm going to give them like a D.
In this chapter pack review, Will rushes us in private messenger and talks for 20 minutes about boring guards.
That's fair. I talked entirely.
You dropped out again.
About that card. Both cards, really.
You dropped out again, by the way.
Damn it.
Manwoody Guard is probably fine. I'm sure there's a deck that really likes this. I don't know what that deck is, but it's there. I functionally promise it'll be a boring little deck that'll do some things that Royal like, which should tell you what deck it is. But fine, whatever. I'm not interested in it. It exists. It's solid. It's probably a CC plus card. Mission in Essos doesn't exist until someone breaks it, and then when someone breaks it, we'll all hate it forever and go, why would they print this? So, those are two things. I'm going to give this house a D plus and move on. Rogers?
It's a C minus house. I agree with Mission Essos. It is a Garbo card until somebody breaks it. It's like there was a deck in first edition that abused of similar effect called what is it? Prince's Plans, right, Aaron? That emptied its deck to the point at which it was just constantly able to cycle things in that it needed.
Prince's Plans was take the top four cards out of your discard pile and add them to your hand. It was
right,
better.
There were other tools that it used to do it, but like a couple of Mission at Essos and a specific effect that you want to recycle could be really powerful. And when people find the exact event package that they need to, with the ability of Annals to fetch it out, we're going to hate this card, as Aaron said. So I would give these guys like a C minus, because House Manwity Guard is a very shaka card that every guard that gets printed in Martell or in any other faction, because it's non-loyal, you look at House Manwity Guard again. But Mission Essos right now useless, but one day broken, so C minus.
Okay. I mean, because they're really hitting that guard trait really hard. I think we're gonna have to watch all the future ones they might print.
Is this what else did they have? No. Is this the like second guard or third guard?
Like how? There's the left and right.
Yeah, but that's not super useful.
Yeah.
Like in Martell, there's
Hotel and the Palace Guard.
That's not
gonna get super. That's it.
Like it's nice, but it's not, you know, phenomenal. Alright, who wants 1/1? Roy wants 1/1 because I want poison coin.
I just read, not me.
Alright, Wanwan is a 6-cost neutral character, unique, 11 strength, no icons, giant, wildling, no attachments except weapon, action, kneel Wanwan to have him participate in a challenge in which you control a participating wildling character. We'll get to the agenda in a little bit. Wanwan will almost certainly see play in that agenda, in a deck built around that agenda, and maybe some other niche wilding based strategies. He's a C plus card.
One quick thing, my main thought here is that of course Roy had to read 1/1, because 1/1 might be the only vegan character we know of in the novels.
There we go.
Did not know that. I don't know. 1/1's fine. He goes in some decks.
It's in his flavor text.
Is it? Oh, cool. Well, vegetarian, you know about vegan, right?
Okay, all right. At least vegetarian.
Fair enough. 1/1's fine. I'll go in, yep, like Rick said, free folk, and maybe some Brotherhood if that ever comes back. And otherwise, he will completely disappear from the game. And, you know, he can beat Gregor in a challenge 1/1, so that's nice, even though I guess he can't technically be alone in a challenge. I'm fine with him. I'm going to say C. Move on.
I think he's probably maybe a little lower than that, unless Revolt really takes off. Because he has to have that other stuff. So I think he's probably only like a plus.
Hey, Glazer, your card.
Right, poison coin. Zero. Well, dash, so you can only play it into shadows, but comes out of shadows for zero, so functionally 2-cost. Shadow event reaction. After you win an unopposed challenge in which you control an attacking character with shadow. Sounds so awkward with, you can say with shadows. With shadows. Place a poison token on a character without shadow controlled by the losing opponent. At the end of the phase, if that character still has a poison token, remove it and kill the character. That's phenomenal. Like, if we're all assuming that critical mass of shadows characters is still coming, right? Like, the instant that happens, this is completely busted and ridiculous. Like, your chump power challenge turn 1 and kill your opponent's best character, and there's very, very little they can do about that to stop, like, at all. So I think this is stupidly good, and at the moment, probably like a B+, but by the end of, if not this cycle, maybe this cycle, but definitely the next cycle, it's an S card. By the way, this is the best skill spell in the game, pretty soon. Welcome back, unfortunately, Joe Miranda.
I think it's definitely a more, in some ways, a more balanced effect than tears because of the unopposed aspect. And it requires a character with shadow or shadows to trigger +2 gold. So there's like 3 things that you need to get it off. I mean, Aaron knows I hate this card. I hate all targeted kill. But I find it very swingy and I don't enjoy it. I know it's an aspect of the game that lots of people like, but I'm not a fan of it. If you're going to print this effect, this is probably where it should be. Where it sits in the card pool right now, this is probably a B. There's not a huge number of characters right now that have the shadow keyword that can win unopposed challenges, but eventually there will be. Mira is one of them, maybe. And on their own, Mira might be one of them. If we get some more with stealth and things like that, we'll see. So, like, I'd give this like a B now.
I have a thing to add to that, though. Like, and if you're not playing against Greyjoy, think about how much unopposed you just let happen, especially early, because you don't especially give a crap. But then also think about how differently, like, you have a couple locations out, and, like, Greyjoy has 1 gold left, and they come at you with a challenge. Think about how much differently the entire game has to play. The entire progression of the game goes just based on that one threat of unopposed. Now, any Shadows character, while there's another card in Shadows, has that same effect on your opponent, or at least can if this gets enough meta play. Because, like, that, like, again, that early chump, that early intrigue where you're just like, I want to get my challenges through, so I'm just going to ignore this one, because who cares, it's 1 power early, like, can completely swing and change the game. And I think that is not to be underestimated.
I mean, I think so, but it does still require, let's say, more checkboxes than other events. You know, higher cost, because this one costs 2, mm-hmm. has to be unopposed, has to be with a specific subset of characters. You know, I think this is good, but not as good as your staff.
I think that we are going to hit a critical mass of Shadows cards, and that will change this conversation.
If we hit that?
I think that that's all. Yeah. No, I think I'm closer to Will here. I think that Aaron has a good point. If we hit a critical mass, particularly, say, like, it's pointing towards, like, Lannister, Martell, and Tyrell being those cards, and, like, Queen of Thorns, there we go, that's a card that very much synergizes well with Poison Coin. She's got stealth. She's got a good strength point. But it's still easier. It's harder to save 2 gold. It's harder to have a card in Shadows than it is to have 1 gold and just... Oh, and harder to win unopposed than it is to just have 1 gold and win an Intrigue Challenge. So while I do think Poison Coin is very powerful removal, it requires more work than other forms of removal that have seen play in the past. And so that's why I think it's a little bit weaker than Tears and Put, but I think it's definitely up there with them. And should the card pool be there, and should there be powerful enough shadow characters that you want to run them, then definitely Poison Coin slots into those decks like no one's business.
There we go. Did we all actually rate Poison Coin?
I did.
Not actually sure that...
I think I gave it a B.
Okay. Yeah, I was about to say I give it a B. I don't think I had, so there we go.
You want to read the agenda? Sure.
We've got a new agenda, the Free Folk. Your plot deck and draw deck can only include neutral cards. Reaction after claim is applied for a challenge which an attacking wildling character. Nil your faction card to apply the claim of another challenge type.
Hey, before you start, all just agree not to make a bunch of stupid jokes for the whole time we're talking about this card about what house it's best out of. Like, it's just, I've been reading those all day and I already want to rip my eyes out. Yeah.
Well, it's best in none of them.
I wasn't planning on it.
That's why I chose the quote I did at the beginning. Like, the free folk should not be supporting a house. They're not going to bend the knee.
I mean, not a house. Maybe a faction.
Sure. Except for all those ones that bowed to...
You know what? We won't talk about that. I still would just rather this had been a house card that said you cannot play agendas or something. Like... Just because it feels silly to me to require a faction card, and you can't use any other cards from that faction at all.
I mean,
I think that this is like a rules fix. Like, the neutral house card created all kinds of like weird, wonky things in the first edition rules, and we already have weird rulings or non-intuitive rulings at the very least about like what's in faction, out of faction.
Sure.
So I think this is, if you're going to do this, this is the like most rule straightforward way to do it, and that's probably what Danny decided.
Gotcha. So okay, let's talk about the effect here then. Now, I want you guys to verify if I'm reading this right, because I'm pretty sure I read it incorrectly at one point here. So the way this is worded is basically like, say I attack and make a military challenge, let's say for one flame. They kill someone, then I immediately kneel my house card, and they're going to have to discard a card or move a power to my house, all off of that same challenge, right?
Correct.
Which is pretty cool. I read it as an interrupt accidentally the first time that changed the claim, which is still, I think, actually pretty good, because it's, you know, kind of tricksy, you know, what will this actually do? But doubling up your effect here is, I think, much better, even. So I really like the effect. Stripping this down to just neutrals does, you know, kind of hamper the pool you've got available, and of course makes everything vulnerable to breaking ties, which in the current meta could definitely be an issue.
Only? But you're stacking power. Like, it's not that huge of a deal, I don't think, for this deck. Like, because your whole deck's going to take it, so you're just going to run a lower curve, I think. Or, like, more economy. And, like, the neutral economy's not that bad.
No. I mean, you've got some options. Especially, you know, when you've got things like Ocean Road that, in this deck, mm-hmm. will function the same as the in-faction, you know, zero-cost reducers. Yep. I don't think you'll actually be hurting for income, like I was worried when I first looked at this. There's a lot of neutral income options now.
I think this is just straight up better than Brotherhood.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it is also just straight up better than Brotherhood.
I agree, but Brotherhood does still give you flexibility on those events, and I think that's one of the biggest drawbacks.
And non-loyal characters and locations and lots of stuff.
Right. But the what I keep looking at or thinking about here with Revolt are really the events, because I think it really shoehorns people into a pretty predictable subset of neutral events. You know, depending on what way you're going with this, probably something fairly aggro. Maybe you're looking at your tears, your put to the swords or torches, maybe nightmares. Maybe if you want to be a little more reactive, you're shields or something, like, and it's a relatively small subset to be predicting there. I don't know, it's just, it feels like that will be more predictable than houses, just because there's a smaller effective pool to choose from.
I think that's probably true, but I don't think there's necessarily not a control or a hand destruction type thing to do with this, or even necessarily a rush. Being able to like get that extra power claim seems real good. Like,
agreed.
There's some other options here. Just being able to hit the hand real hard early game, use this as like a pseudo reset mid game, might work as control. Like, there's some real choices. Like, if you're getting four cards per turn from an opponent's hand, like, even Martell can't survive that.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Aaron, I'm sorry. I thought you were finished. So the question I think we haven't really asked ourselves is this effect, which I think is actually one of the most powerful effects that has been printed on an agenda. I mean, can we agree this? Like the fact that you get two challenge claims for one challenge without all you have to do is win that challenge with the wildling, right? Like this.
You don't get two. So. To apply the claim of another challenge. You can't win a power and get two power.
Oh, yeah.
Right. But that's what I meant. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. What I meant was you get a military claim, then you get intrigue claim, right? If that's how I work. That's how it reads to me, right? So I win a military challenge with...
You get military claim, then you also get intrigue claim.
Or power, whatever. Right. So you get two challenges worth of claim, like two challenge types. I should have been clearer. Worth a claim on a single challenge, right? I think that's the single most powerful effect printed on an agenda so far, right?
Yeah. Probably. It's up there.
Maybe Reigns is maybe the only one, but...
If you're ignoring cost, sure.
Yeah. So is only running neutral cards worth that effect? Wildlings has constantly almost been there. In my testing for Thrones War, I played a lot of Night's Watch Winter Wildlings, and it was an extremely good deck, but it was very punishing. It had very few little margin for error, largely because it was missing an effect like this, an effect to turn early advantages into crushing your opponent. And or an ability to quickly come from behind if you fall behind because of an effect like Breaking Ties. So the fact that this agenda lets a Wildlings package do that, and the fact that the Wildling package has access to some of the best draw in the game in the form of Dala, and other tricky tools like Vowel and Mace and Rattleshirt.
Faramir
is just really, really strong. Like I do agree with Will that like it might be end up being a very linear deck that like is very overall relatively predictable. There's only so many Wildlings, there's only so many neutral events. But like and you can run that Wildlings passage alongside a Brotherhood package. And they synergize together pretty well. You have closers available to you in the form of Barrack, in the form of Mance. I think that this agenda will see play. Whether or not it becomes more than just a good tier 2 deck, I don't know. But every time Danny prints a Wildling character, you got to revisit this. It's certainly going
to... Wildlings. Like, this is going to run Littlefinger, this is going to run Jacken, and this is going to run the Poor Fellows.
I mean, I agree that you're going to run that whole package as well, but like at the end of the day... You still need an attacking Wildling character, and the better Wildling characters get, the better this agenda gets.
Yeah, I just think there's a number of excellent, excellent Wildling characters already.
I mean, again, I think I listed a bunch of them, Aaron. Like, we're not too far apart here, but my point is, I don't think this is immediately. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, and this next weekend or the weekend after or what's the next major tournament that I know of, the Maryland Neck, maybe a Free Folk deck wins it and just smashes the field. But I don't think it's quite there, but I think it can be in the future. Yeah. And you will see people playing Free Folk at tournaments, and you'll see them in the top half of Swiss, whether they break.
I think what? Once store championship season comes around, especially when we're in that card drought, that folks are going to come around to something like this when they want something new to tinker with, like at a tournament, but something a little more low key. I think we'll see Free Folk start to take off then.
Also, by the way, it beats the living shit out of Tyrell.
Yeah, Tyrell does not like this.
Crushes Tyrell's face off. This and Sark should be the nail in the coffin of Tyrell as 1A. It pushes it firmly to the second best house, I think. Because, oh my god, does Trell just cry when you're hitting with fucking four-plane military challenges? Then it can do nothing
yeah,
about.
I can vouch for that. that happened to me at Nationals. I believe it was four characters wiped off of my board the first three turns of the game, every turn.
And if they have Jock in, you just cry.
That hurt.
Yeah.
This can easily run the Bloody Flux and be like, you want to save something? Good luck. Get three claim with the Wildling attachment. Like, there's some real stuff.
Yeah.
So, strong. Did anybody rate it at this point? I'm not sure anybody did.
I will give it a B. B plus.
I will give it an S. I think.
Wow.
I would not be. Spoiler: Lances aren't bringing it. Like, genuinely not. I don't do that Jesse bullshit with the Drown God. Like, I think this kind of deck's probably too boring for me, and I'm going to try and find something more interesting. This is not going to be our world deck. But if this won worlds, I would not be shocked.
Okay. Definitely higher than me. I was going to put it in the B range as well.
All right. Let's bring it home with Winter Reserves. It is a 5-0-1-6 neutral plot. Kingdom and Winter. It breaks my heart every time that it's a Kingdom plot. While Winter Reserves is in your used pile, increase the gold value and reserve value on your revealed Winter plot by one. I think this is actually a plot that will probably go in a Free Folk deck. It makes all those two claim Winter plots that have such terrible reserve and terrible gold, like turning Winds of Winter into a 4-5-1-6 is very powerful.
It doesn't increase initiative.
Oh, I think four. I can't remember what the initiative.
Make it like a 4-4-2-6.
It's four. Okay. Yeah. 4-4-4-2-4-4-2-6 is very powerful. Same with famine becoming Winds, 5 reserve and 3 gold.
The bad one that loses a power from you is now 5-5-5-0-2-5.
Yeah. That's a pretty real plot.
5-1-2-5 or something like that. Like, also, yeah. Guys, this is not Buffett Limiter.
Yeah.
Your 5 gold and 7 reserve for Snow of Winter is calling. Sorry, 8 reserve.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily. I mean, and then it actually makes you look a little bit more at the Winter agenda. The ability to take away the drawback from yourself and increase your gold from the Winter agenda is pretty cool. And you know, this is a solid opener on the Winter agenda as a 5-5 gold 5 reserve plot in the Winter agenda. I think makes you relook at it. It's a relatively safe opener for Winter decks as well. The Kingdom breaks my heart a little bit with Naval Superiority slightly coming back into the meta. But this is a really strong plot. This is an A plot, and I would expect to see it played. And I would expect Winter to start becoming more common, which is another bad thing for Tyrell. So, hey.
Agreed.
I think it's an S plot. It's unbelievable.
This one is pretty high impact. Potentially in the meta at large by pushing a lot, kind of a ripple effect down the other plot line. So while its actual text here is maybe a little more low key, I think the overall ripple effect of how much those other ones see play, I mean, this is going to be pretty high impact.
Sorry, it can't be an S by definition. It has to be an A because it won't lose in that specific deck. I just think it takes Winter decks from obscurity to mattering, and it's literally what makes Free Folk work.
Famine is super good with this. I just want to come back around to this. Turning Famine into a 3-0-2-5 that your opponent's characters are increased by cost by one is just so good. This is a Dan Struhal plot.
I mean, I think it's literally almost every Winter plot that improves, except I guess the one that doesn't care about initiative, because who cares? Like,
Yeah, you're only using that for specific applications anyway. Applications that Aaron will never.
And like there was some like winter decks that wanted a big gold winter plot, and sometimes you saw that one come out if they didn't want Winter Festival. And so, yeah, this definitely basically says if you're interested in winter as even just a sub theme of your plot deck, Winter Reserves is worth it.
Yeah. I don't think
and
you're
it's
wrong.
Super powerful in wars to come.
Yeah.
Also accurate. Ugh. Yeah, it's really silly in wars. Like, if wars gets an aggro build going. I mean, even just Stark Wars, right? Like, your doggy plot with 4 gold and 7 reserves. Pretty nice.
Oh, it's winter. Yeah. I had forgotten it was.
Yeah, like a Stark. We know mid-range winter is
5-7-1-6 for nothing burns. Mm-hmm. Those are some real stats. Jesus. Mm-hmm.
And
I'm gonna go look up
and a war and a wars deck can do things like winter reserves, some other plot, third turn winter reserves as kind of a half. So then it becomes your second winter reserves becomes 6-7 like and then all future winter plots go up 2. It's
if you're playing long game you could also save that second winter reserves for last plot so that you're always already set.
Yep.
You don't have to waste time. It's real nice. I'm looking up winter plots just so I can feel grossed out for a minute. Great.
Yeah. There you go.
Got it.
There's a lot of options that I look at a lot harder at this kind of with
this
kind of
boost. This card makes Will a lot harder. Time for Wolves, barring early frost. Fall spring with 6 gold, 6 reserve. Famine. It's Frozen Expanse. That's not terrible.
Simone's plot with this is pretty good.
Simone's plot with this is silly. Ranger's Cash with this is actually really nice. If you make that a 4-7, that's not bad at all. Snow Dunder is one that never sees. Long Winter wins for Snow. Withering Simone plot doesn't need this, but it sure doesn't hate having more gold in reserve. Winter Festival's not going to be mad at it. And Wraiths, which is the one that I think there's at least. Although turn 2 Wraiths isn't the worst play.
A 5 gold.
You're running what, Winter Agenda.
5 reserve.
Five gold, 6.
6 reserve Wraiths.
Yeah. Turn 2. And then you're just like, alright, well. Oh, and then you go into Wildling Agenda and say you can't have a hand.
Or you go into Famine after that. So you go Winter Reserves, Wraiths, Famine, or Famine Wraiths.
You can also just go Winter Reserves, Famine, go heavy military claim for the first 2 turns, them and they have no hand, just keep intriguing them.
Yep.
Right? Like, just be like, all right, now you're down to 3 cards, and by 2 claim intrigue is going to completely wreck your world.
So yeah, this is a very good pack. Yeah, I hope you've found this from episode of The White Book.
Power is a creeping.
It's creeping in some different ways, which is nice.
Very true.
But we still did get a very good mace card and a ridiculous Stark card. So,
you think the meta is getting more interesting? Except that controls remains in its slow, painful death spiral. From its mild high of around Thrones War.
I'm not even sure if it's slow death spiral at this point.
Matt Clemens did well at U.S. Nationals, won a regional with it. You did well at Fracas and at Gen Con. Like,
it's a real deck. It's just, like, if you subtract Varys and add both Mira and Vince to the meta, like, is real hard to play.
No, that's true. I just, I mean, there needs to be, I mean, Aaron and I have talked about this many times, there needs to be more control events printed.
Well,
that are hard to interact with.
At 3 words, let it bleeds.
Yeah, I mean, if there was a 3 gold really strong control event.
You made Westeros Bleeds, which is basically Varys. Just keep it in the Dom and make it a 4 or 5 gold event. Done.
It's tough to interact with.
Like, yeah. Control. Yeah, but sure. But you have to save 5 gold to Dom. You have to protect your hand. Right, anyone who's running it.
No. Yeah. The strength of Westeros Bleeds is events were a lot harder to interact with in first edition. Unless you're in a control mirror.
In second edition, Dome is a power challenge is a para. The 2 gold other Martell. Like, there's a lot of options for canceling that. But there's still fewer options, and they're harder to use than the literal, like, 1,000 ways to stop Varys right now.
Yep, I agree.
So, yeah. Danny, if you're listening, I know you're not listening, give us Westeros Bleeds. Or, hey, Ryan Jones, or Chris Schoenthal, or who else has a champ card? Mikey Pandorf, who definitely isn't listening to this podcast. Or Corey, I think, still has one, right?
He does. So does Ryan Hart. Ryan Hart has 2.
Right, one of you, 4 or 5 gold, Westeros Bleeds. Do it. Your face can be on it. I already begged Schoenthal. He went, I don't like resets. Oh, there's someone else. So, somebody, Westeros Bleeds, please. Pretty please, Sugar and Spice. I'm your best friend. You can join Long Lances, I promise.
Well, Aaron, if I win Worlds, not happen.
And Second Sons. You can join Long Lances and Second Sons.
I promise you, Aaron, I will design Westeros Bleeds. If I win a card design. John still has a card design.
There we go.
John who?
Darknosh.
No, he doesn't. He only ever got one.
He won, got one for when he won Canadian Nationals.
You didn't get it. There was no card design.
Was there no card design?
Okay. Yeah, I don't know that they've ever had
card design. He used his Nationals. It was dual. His card design is dual. There's a few outstanding. Mikey is the real key here. Mikey Pandorf is the real key here.
There you go.
I'm one of the, like, 3 people he still talks to in the community.
I saw him at DevCon, so, you know.
Yeah. Maybe. I'm the one who got him to come out.
Yeah. Maybe you can do it.
Let it bleed.
Okay, how about some props and slops? I think Roy has
Westeros Bleeds.
Aaron was quick with that.
Right?
I think Roy had a slop he was sitting on. I could have sworn.
Whatever, I'm going to pop the free bottom practice and all the people there. I don't want to list names. You know who you are because I'm going to not list people. And. Like, I'm going to feel super guilty. So, I love every single person I met there. I don't even want to shout out Metis, I'm just going to forget. But, like, genuinely, the most amazing time with the most amazing people. If you can go to one tournament in the world, and I will probably never make Solid, it's the Frakus. And, like, I fully plan to go back because that was unfreaking believable. Like, the best time, the best people. Everyone was ridiculously friendly, like pure family, pure drinking, pure fun. Like, I love sleep more than basically anything. I never wanted to go home. Like, wow. It was genuinely fantastic. Genuinely fantastic. Every moment. If only they drank anything but vodka. Even their vodka is better than vodka anywhere else, though. Like, I won't drink vodka here, but it was really good there.
Closer to the source.
So, if you can save up and go to the practice, A, tell me in advance, I'll go to, but B, like, do so. Roy Rogers. This is still probably not back.
Guess not.
I'm right here. I've been here for a while.
Oh, congrats. All right, go ahead. Slap what you want to say.
Well, I'm going to prop up several things. Have we been on an episode of this since Gen Con? I don't think we haven't, right? We haven't been on White Books since Gen Con.
Wait, I thought we did a chapter.
Yeah.
Did we?
Yeah, we did a...
Okay. So I did prop Gen Con then, so I'll skip over that. But I will also prop the New Jersey next event, Lord of the Crossing. Mike Lamzik did a really good job organizing it, and we've only got one more stop. So if you are on the Northeast and you can make it out to Bay of Crabs, the 22nd of September, hosted by friend of the show, Todd Moyer, you should definitely do that. It'll be a great time. Dennis Harrison is coming out of retirement for that event and for Thrones Toberfest this year. So that's,
you see, Dennis.
I'm building Dennis's deck for both events as well. So it'll be
hello. Great. You better have a lot of cards.
If you get Dennis, there's a lot of other people who want the.
I just need my deck built. So.
Oh yeah, you'll get it. As long as you don't draft Dennis. So, and I think
I'm drafting Dennis. It's me or Thane. Yeah. No one else even knows him.
Yeah. So I think Thane will end up with him, but that's just my prediction. The other thing I want to prop is by the time this will have gone up, Thrones Toberfest 2018's draft will be over. And I want to appreciate everybody for participating. It'll be exciting. I'm really excited for Thrones Toberfest. We have some really exciting announcements about prize support coming soon. And then finally, one more prop before I get to my slop. I want to prop Amazon Prime for having the finest piece of fantasy, a televised fantasy of all time, which is NBC's Merlin. No, not what? The Merlin that they imported from the BBC, but the one starring Sam Neill from the 90s.
Oh, shoot. I forgot about that.
Which is the single greatest piece of fantasy ever put on screen. Sorry, Game of Thrones. It is why I am a fantasy fan. Was watching that when I was younger. Honest to goodness, no shade, not joking. Completely serious. And then slop, my air conditioner breaking while the East Coast of the United States is on one of its worst heat waves in many, many years. Thanks, Global Weirding.
How
for that
warm
one.
Is it over there?
It's terrible. It's in my apartment right now. It's 87 degrees. And then, like, who knows, since it's even hotter next to my computer.
Oh, there's something I want to prop, and I can't think of it.
Not fun indoors this time of night.
Oh. I want to prop the Adventure Zone. The Adventure Zone is a Dungeons & Dragons-ish podcast. And people have been telling me to listen to it forever, and I've been putting it off forever. And now, I sneak off to find time where I can listen to it. It's completely, completely phenomenal and worth listening to. And I strongly recommend people listen to The Adventure Zone.
Nice.
Have you listened to it?
Yeah. Oh. I've listened to it. I mean, I'm not caught all the way up, but I have definitely started it. And yeah, it's pretty fun.
Nice. And Johnny Wright loves it too. And he is a man of impeccable taste.
Oh man. Let's see. Got a couple.
Your national stuff.
Well, I was gonna say, got a couple props here. One is our trip to Europe was also phenomenal, and I mostly didn't want to come back. Scotland is so gorgeous, just everywhere, and we covered a lot, like 18 hours of driving, give or take. We were a little under the speed limit, so maybe more like 20 hours of driving while we were there, one stop to the next and all over. It was amazing, and the whole place did not look real. I felt like I was watching a movie. So that was a little trippy, but very cool. And then the other one is just a very, very short props to U.S. Nationals. Props to FFG for letting us take the opportunity to run it this year. Thanks to Greg and Kevin and Daryl, who actually handled all of the administrative stuff during the day, getting deck lists and checking them, getting everybody registered, actually making rulings. They actually ran most all of the show, except for letting me have fun making announcements and doing raffle prizes. So
They put a lot of time and effort into this as volunteers, and I want to make sure they get credit where that is due. Also, of course, everybody that came to come play, we had 72, I believe, for the joust in the final count. I didn't go take a look at the count myself, but I believe I was told 24 states represented. So nearly half the union here was pretty awesome. So I hope everyone else had a good time. It was exhausting and fun, and I will mostly leave it at that because we're trying to get all three of the champs on for the next episode. So I'm sure we'll chat a whole lot more nationals than that.
Props to Dustin Archer, whose blades are sharp.
Absolutely. Big plus mm-hmm. to Dustin. Good guy.
And Tommy and Jesse, just to make sure I mention the other champs as well.
Oh, yeah.
Not mad at Jesse.
Well, then.
Props to Tommy, though. Miss you, Tommy.
Yeah? Tommy, coin flip pills.
Yeah, we'll talk about that situation next week.
No, it's super great. Keeping it in the White Book family mostly. And so Storm Bros and White Book not dominated U.S. Nationals. It's pretty good for us.
Is Storm Bros a podcast or just a really stupid name?
Yeah, it lives in the danger zone. Ooh. So it's both.
That closes this chapter of the White Book.